Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Christina Namath, Travel Director of the Commonwealth Club. I'm pleased this evening to introduce Terry Watson, the Executive Director of the Farallones Marine Sanctuary Association. Established in 1995, the Farallones Marine Sanctuary Association is the nonprofit partner that supports and assists the Gulf of the Farallones National Marine Sanctuary in education, outreach, and stewardship. Terry's career has spanned two tracks, nonprofit environmentalism and aviation. Her nonprofit leadership experience includes serving as the executive director and flight operations director of Lighthawk, where she still serves as the aviation chair on the board of directors, as well as branch director, operations manager, and senior field instructor for the National Outdoor Leadership School. She is a current instructor for Knowles Wilderness Medicine Institute. Her commercial flying career began as an Army Aviation Intelligence Officer and spans 27 years and over 10,000 flight hours in airplanes and helicopters, both internationally and in the Rocky Mountain West. Terry did her undergraduate work in geology and sports medicine at the College of William and Mary in Virginia, obtained her master's in computer information systems from USC, and has completed her PhD coursework in remote sensing GIS integration in geoscience applications at Oregon State University. Please welcome Terry Watson.
And despite being a pilot, these high-tech things are a little intimidating, so bear with me as I get to use them. Oddly, my track is in aviation. My hobby up until this point has been environmentalism, and the recent recession has provided me a wonderful opportunity to move over into environmentalism and learning about the ocean as a profession, and it's been a real treat. You all, I understand, about half in the room are going out to the Farallones on a sailboat on the 30th, 31st, which is just amazingly fun. This is a picture of folks going out to the Farallones on the boat you'll be going on, and I put it there just to give you the heads up. No matter what the weather looks like here, no matter what the forecast is here, dress like you're going skiing when it's going to rain, and you'll be warm enough. Take all the layers and then a bag to take them off in case it's warmer than you think, but don't get caught the other way. Okay, there we go. When you go to the Farallones, what people always ask me and what I wanted to talk about is, what's out there? I mean, it's outside the bridge, it's dragons, who knows what's out there. These are some naturalists with the kind of classic whale poster. And the first thing I want to tell you that's out there before we get to animals is there's like lines in the water out there. Well, maybe not, but there are national marine sanctuaries out there. And a little bit about those is kind of cool in setting the stage about why the ocean outside of San Francisco is so amazingly special. The fact that we have three national marine sanctuaries right outside the Golden Gate tells us something's going on out there. And this diagram kind of gives you the impression, and you can kind of see it, that the water from the coast all the way out past the Farallones, now see, I've got to navigate walking and holding the microphone. Okay, I won't do that. You can see the Farallon Islands. The water depth is about 60-ish feet. You get up to the Farallones, it's about 160, 180 feet. And then where it goes dark blue, the mobile microphone. Where it goes dark blue, there we go. This little drop-off here called the Farallon Escarpment, it drops down to about 6,000 feet, which is fairly stunning. As National Marine Sanctuaries go, the three of them outside our gate are part of a system of 14 in the United States. And I wanted to put this extra map here to show that these three National Marine Sanctuaries, Gulf of the Farallones, Cordell Bank, and Monterey Bay, are immediately adjacent to the 9 million people of us that live terrestrially here in San Francisco Bay. That's pretty wild, too. Next-door neighbors. Once you start kind of looking at what's underwater, you see that besides the shallow shelf and the deep drop-off, there's islands. They stick up above the water. Shoals, they're right underneath the water so that ships can hit them and wreck. They're famous in our history. And banks, where the water shallows and fish really aggregate and are commercially viable or commercially important within our fisheries here in San Francisco. This is the part of the Farallones and our coast that's important to really kind of get a handle on. That steep drop-off, these are the Farallon Islands here, and that's the Golden Gate Bridge right there. The water just out past the Farallones, about 3 to 4 miles over the shelf break, just plunges right down to the depths. At 6,000 feet down there, it's dark, it's cold, and it's full of nutrients. And the way that things work in the ocean is that nitrates, phosphates, calcium, all kinds of goodies go down and live in the deep, deep waters. I always think of it like Miracle-Gro. Those deep waters have a lot of Miracle-Gro in them. The huge Pacific Ocean basin, you can kind of get your head around this picture, that's the west coast of North America, this is Eurasia, this is the whole Pacific Gyre. The way that the Earth rotates, the sun heats the water, the winds blow, sets up this huge orbiting current. And the edge of the current over against our coast is called the California Current. As the wind blows down the coastline driven by that California Current, I'm not going to get too complicated into the whys and hows, but the gist of it is the wind moves the water gets pushed out to sea, and that deep, deep water gets sucked up from the depths onto that shelf, kind of backfills the void that it creates. And we have a phenomenon called upwelling. The upwelling is strongest when the winds are strongest, which is in generally the springtime, persists through the summer, and will eventually taper off later into this winter. We still have some good upwelling going on right now. There's only 4 places in the world we have this kind of persistent, predictable upwelling on a big area scale. So here in California, we have one. The other ones you can always see, they're on the eastern edge of ocean basins or western edges of continents. The numbers vary depending on who you want to quote, but the numbers that you can kind of throw out are 1 to 5% of the Earth's oceans are areas of this persistent upwelling, and they're responsible for 30 to 50% of our commercial fishing catch. They're very, very productive areas. They're very important for ocean health as well as for us as humans. We're an ocean-dependent nation when it comes to food. This is an image that uses temperature to just kind of show you that niftily, the upwelling, that cold, deep water, is concentrated around Point Reyes, and then right there is the islands right there. And you can see that we have an upwelling center here that not only is the upwelling up and down the coast, but it's quite profound. And that's because that shelf break is so close to the island, so close to our shore. It's right out there. So we got the cold water, the Miracle-Gro. The Miracle-Gro comes up. When you put a lot of fertilizer into an environment that has a lot of single-celled phytoplankton, little one-celled animals that use chlorophyll, sun hits them, they undergo photosynthesis, bloom, and blossom. The phytoplankton get eaten by the zooplankton, get eaten by the bigger things. The bigger things are the krill. And the krill right here, this little guy, there's 2 species, but one most predominantly found here. This krill is the key species in the Farallones ecosystem. Basically, if there's a good krill year, there's a good animal year. If it's a bad krill year, it's a bad animal year. Bad meaning animals die and starve. Because everybody comes here to eat this guy or the people that eat it. Maybe not the people, but you know what I mean. Maybe we'll be people. We'll talk about that later. The krill swarm in these huge clouds. They're kind of orange. You may see, last weekend we did see a bunch of krill in clouds when we went out. Big orange clouds of this stuff. If you see the krill, go there. Because that's where the birds feed, and that's where the marine mammals feed. That's what the whales eat, and that's what everything else eats or eats things that eat it. So that was my little intro to marine sanctuaries and why the ocean is so productive out there. This is going out on a trip. This is a friend that's got the Marine Mammal Handbook. They may or may not have handouts for you on the boat. I don't know if there's naturalists going. Okay, but the crew on those boats are going to be people like me. We may not be your PhDs in marine science, but we are passionately interested in the critters, and we know a lot of things just because we're kind of nerdy that way. We're here giving a talk like this instead of seeing the giants. So, if you wanted to get a book, the Marine Mammal book that the Audubon Society prints is just an awesome reference. The Golden Gate, this is the perspective we're used to seeing, kind of terrestrial base from the Marin Headlands, looking back at the city. This is the view you'll see from your ship. Going under the Golden Gate, if that's a new experience for you, is something to celebrate. Do a little dance, have some coffee, do something. But when you go out, you're crossing the line that divides San Francisco Bay from the North Pacific Ocean. The North Pacific Ocean. It's cold out there. It's wet. It's wavy. These people are dressed. This is a typical summer day out in the Farallons. Hats, gloves, warm layers just are the norm. You may luck out. You guys are going for the statistically nicest weather. October, first part of November, could be mellow without wind, could be sunny. Hasn't been lately. Dress warm. Big stormy days can happen later on in the winter. If the weather looks like this, you won't be going out. The folks at Berkeley are smart people, and they won't subject themselves, their boats, or you to this. Once you pass Point Bonita, which most of us know from visiting over at Golden Gate National Recreation Area, you're really in the wilds of the Gulf of the Farallones National Marine Sanctuary. Most people, when they go out, think, oh, let's get to the islands, but they're 29 miles out. En route to the islands, you're going to see a lot of things. And in fact, if you don't see these guys before you get to Point Bonita Light, I'll be surprised. These are little harbor porpoises. These guys are 2.5 to 5 feet long. And I'm trying to, in my presentation, show you the fuzzy pictures that look like what you actually see from the boat, and then the pretty pictures you see in the books that tell you what they look like that you won't see. So when you see the little back flash up and the little dorsal fin that looks like a chocolate chip there, a little triangle, these guys are furtive. They're generally solitary. Maybe they travel in pairs. And they almost always are found in the little tide lines. When you're going out the gate, you'll see these places where the water is swirling and it looks like there's a line in the water. It's where the floating garbage is. It's where the seaweed and the foam. And in that tide line, you're going to see feeding birds and harbor porpoises. So if you see a tide line, just keep your eyes peeled, and you'll see these little guys. They, if you can see this one, you actually can see his face. They don't really have noses like Flipper. They're porpoises. And they rarely show you this much of their body. What you normally see on these little critters is about this much of their back. So to you, they look like really dark little things with chocolate chip cookies or little chocolate chips on their back. And you usually don't see their light undersides. Later on, we'll talk about dolls, porpoises, and how they look different. But they're both very small. And that's a classic look up close at harbor porpoises. These things are really common, those harbor porpoises, but there's just been a new permit issued in our area to study them, so maybe we'll learn something about them, because we actually don't know a lot. The other thing that I'll be shocked if you don't see by the time you get to Point Bonita are the sea lions. We all know these from Pier 39. The ones that if you go to SeaWorld, when they say look at the performing seal, they actually mean sea lion. The California sea lions here like to hang out on anything that's above water. This is obviously a aid to navigation. They also like to crawl on boats. They hang out in the sun, and they, like all seals and sea lions, I didn't know this until recently, they all molt or shed their hair in the summer, just like my cat. So they climb out, they molt, they kind of trade the old hair for the new, and they get ready for a kind of take a break in the whole breeding cycle. When you see these guys, when they come up to you in the water, they're the ones that kind of come up, look at you, and dive. And they're big. And they've got, if you can see their little heads, they have little ears. They're called eared seals. If you see the males, they have kind of these protuberant bumps on their heads. It's called a sagittal crest. And what's kind of interesting about sea lions is that these pinnipeds, or webbed feet little guys, their forearms and their rear flippers, take a little side note, it's generally believed that marine mammals were once terrestrial animals that returned to the sea for reasons we don't know, but that's what we think they did. These guys, the sea lions, maintain the ability to use their fore flippers and their rear flippers as legs. So they actually will stand on their forearms, walk around on their forearms, and you can actually see the ones that aren't really huge using, they actually can walk on all fours, and you can see air underneath their bellies. That's one way to tell if it's a sea lion. Most of the sea lions we have on the Farallons at this time of year are the males who've come up from the Channel Islands. Kind of the way that the sea lion thing works is that they breed, the moms and the pups are mostly found down in the Channel Islands. There are some small rookeries up here. And once the pups are born and the moms are nursing them, the males get to kind of like skylark up north and have some good old hang time, and they come and hang out at the Farallons and up further north in these large conglomerates. The other little head that you'll see peeking at you as you head out, probably before you get to Point Bonita, is the harbor seal. A harbor seal looks like, to me it always looks like my dog. His head is much more round. He's littler. He's got a little spotty colors. This guy is almost uniformly gray, but he's got a few little spots, those cute whiskers. They vary in coloration as much as dogs vary in coloration, but they're all kind of spotty. They are, aside from being really cute, they're insanely curious. These are the ones that will kind of peek up and follow you around and check out your boat. And these, if you can look at them closely, they don't have ear, or they don't have ear flaps. They do have ears. They can hear things. But they, my little brother used to call them sea slugs. The harbor seals and the seals didn't maintain the ability to walk on their fore flippers or rear feet when they went back into the ocean. So when they haul out, they scooch around on their bellies like little slugs and don't really have the use of their hands for anything other than steering in the water. And that's a youngin' out there. Harbor seals are year-round residents in our waters and very, very common. Once you get out into the more pelagic environment where you look back and maybe the bridge has disappeared into the fog or it just looks like it's far away and faded, you start finding the species that are less coastal or terrestrial-based. This is a Pacific white-sided dolphin, really, really common in our waters. It has, remember I said the porpoise had that little chocolate chip kind of triangle thing on his back? Dolphins have little sickle-shaped things on their back. These dorsal fins have kind of more of a hook shape to them, and they have that really distinct white patch there and white patch here. I like their name, Pacific white-sided, because you will see them and you'll go, wow, what was that white-sided dolphin I just saw? You'll often see them much more like this. The dolphins that we do have out here are usually in large schools, and they're usually very playful. If your boat is going under sail or under motor, these are the ones we'll get in the bow and ride along with you. I call these the forgiving dolphins because my sailboat will only go 5 or 6 knots. That's 7 or 8 miles an hour. And these dolphins, Pacific white-sided, will come, and they'll hang with my boat for a long time. They don't mind that I'm slow. There's another kind of Dahl's porpoise that if I can't go 15 knots, they just really don't want to play with me. I'm boring. They leave. That's a nice classic one. I've never seen them that close. But. And probably what most of you think of when you've signed up for this trip is you're going to go looking for whales. And there's some really important things to remember about looking for whales. This is a classic day in October. This is actually from maybe 2 weeks ago. On a really nice calm day. Not much in the way of waves, a little bit of wind, very gray. So when you're looking for whales, you're doing two things. You're scanning and you're looking for these kind of vague, puffy clouds of smoke-looking thing. And you're looking for something dark in the water that looks different than the rest of the dark bits of water. The other really important thing about looking for whales is the best way to not get seasick. So go to the rail, get good fresh wind in your face, look at the horizon, take your Captain Ahab pose, keep looking at the horizon, and you'll avoid getting seasick. Keeping your eyes outside is really good. We've been seeing lots of humpbacks and blue whales for the past 3 to 4 weeks, and I'd be surprised if you don't see any. Humpback whales, my little diagram here. The kind of diagnostic thing you'll see on humpback whales is this really funny-shaped dorsal fin, and the fact that when they blow, it just looks like a little white round puffball, a little cotton ball. Doesn't go very high. And the other thing that if you get closer to them or you can see them is that they often stick their arms or their tails out of the water. That's a classic humpback or pair of humpbacks that were following us around. The humpbacks here are really friendly. In fact, there's 2 boats that I swear have painted the bottoms of their boats with special humpback-flavored paint. So if you see Kitty Cat or think of the other one in a second because we always follow them, they always find the humpbacks. You can see that after they start to dive, that back kind of arches, gives them their name. They also have these little things along their back called knuckles, kind of like you can see the processes of their spine. You can see that there again. They have this funny little nubby dorsal fin and those little ridges along the back. Humpbacks are interesting. These are the ones that when you hear songs of the humpback whales, these do sing. And things I've learned about humpbacks that I think are kind of cool. The male humpbacks are the ones that sing. There are 3 distinct humpback groups, or families isn't the right word biologically, but groupings, populations, is the word I'm looking for. All the males in a population sing the same song. They may sing the song and then like do a repeat and change a few notes, But in general, it's the same song. And the song changes each season, and they all change the same way. So, you know, we surmise that it's a form of communication, but those are things that are observed. Don't know where they rehearse. Don't know who writes their score. Need to find that out. Humpbacks have got these funny little tubule things on their tails and different colorations. If you do see any whales, and especially humpbacks out there, and you get pictures like this where you can see flukes or tails or fins very clearly, and you get a great picture, I want a copy. Every one of these is individually unique. There's not that many humpbacks out there. About 1,500 is the current estimate. And they actually know each one as an individual. So you can see that guy's tail heading on down. If we're lucky, and this has happened, I've been out about 30 times, and I think I'd say 1 in 5 times we get to see the flying whales. It's really stunning and shocking when you turn around and you see a whale in the air. It doesn't seem quite right. But these guys are very playful. They breach. When they breach, they throw their arms or flukes around. Their species name is Megaptera, or big arms, big waving arms. They're the whales you swear, if they start doing this breaching and checking you out around your boat, you will swear they're trying to tell you something, like, Timmy, Lassie has fallen into the well, or, hi, I think you're as strange looking as you think I am. But they will come up and they'll look you straight in the eye. I think they like the colors we wear with our bright jackets. I have no idea. The scientists say that that's not happening, but I don't believe them. This is a stock photograph. This isn't from out there, but I have seen this out in our islands. The day that I saw this, we had one that danced for us for 45 minutes. He would do 4 and 5 breaches at a time, start gasping for air, kind of hang out on the surface, recover, then do it again and again and again. And these are big baleen whales. I like this picture because you can see these little accordion pleats. When he's, you know, jumping, that's all tucked in. When this whale is feeding, he opens that big mouth there, and those pleats expand, and he runs through those big clouds of krill, and he has these big things called baleen, which look kind of like strainers in his mouth, and he gets bunches of those krill and eat them. These are the biggest animals on Earth, and these aren't the biggest animals on Earth, whales generically, and they eat some of the littlest. We'll talk about blues, which are the biggest, next. Blue whales are the largest mammal that has ever existed on this earth, hands down. They're monsters. The ones we have here are about 85 foot long as their kind of generic length. The ones down in the Antarctic are around 100 feet long. When I asked the biologists, you know, why are they bigger down there, the scientific answer is, well, we haven't ascertained why. The answer that they say they can't prove is that the krill down there are bigger, so they think maybe bigger krill make bigger whales. Kind of like Iowa corn-fed whales, something like that. Blues are really interesting to watch. The most characteristic thing that you'll see from a distance is this blow. I call it the Old Faithful blow. It's a long, tall column. It's tall and thin. It's not rounded at all. It goes straight up and down. When they blow, their blow goes straight up. The Moby Dick whale, the sperm whale, his blow goes up at about 45 degrees, and we generally don't have sperm whales up here. So you'll see that blow. When you see them surfing, you'll see this ridiculously tiny little dorsal fin. Like, what in the heck does it do? It's so small in the length of the body. But normally you see this picture. And what's interesting is that when you see them doing this, you realize you're only seeing a small percentage of their actual body. Comparatively, those are those big great white sharks we're scared of. Those are killer whales, which are pretty big. And that's a blue whale. That's a blue whale 2 weeks ago. And it's funny. When I first came here and saw blue whales, I was like, well, they're not blue. Why do you call them blue whales? When you see them above water, they are actually this dark gray, kind of mottly color. This guy has a smooth back, no knuckles, and that little tiny dorsal fin that's kind of straight up and down. That's a little out of order, sorry. That's my hugest mammal comparative thing. Blue whales are called blue whales because underwater they look really blue. So this is one underwater in some relatively clear water. They've kind of got that little downturned smile. They open up that big mouth, and they also are baleen whales. They filter krill. They eat 5 tons of krill a day. I think the coolest thing about blue whales, again, whales are still in that group of marine mammals, once were terrestrial, for some reason went back to sea. When you think about an animal that used to be terrestrial that goes back to sea and the adaptations it's going to have to undergo to pull that off, you could think about adding blubber so they stay warm in the cold water. You think about kind of getting rid of arms and legs and turning them into fins. And you think about the fact that most terrestrial animals have their noses on the front of their face. And if you're swimming, that's relatively inconvenient. So they move the nose to the top of the head, and I swear it looks like a big human nose stuck on the top of the whale. The cool thing about this blowhole and the blue whale is he's got little splash guards here, because they do move pretty fast when they're actually traveling, so they have a little splash guard to keep the water out of their noses. And their nostrils are aimed kind of in and together, and that's why you get that big, tall columnar blow. It looks like a single column, but it's coming out of two nostrils. Fighting a cold like I am right now, I look at that and go, wow, I wonder if whales get colds. That'd be bad. And then blue whales, you can see that nose is still fairly prominent. And they're just big, thick-bodied, heavy animals with these tails on the end that aren't that big relative to their bodies. And when they dive, their tails, just like their bodies, there's no barnacles, there's no knuckles. They're pretty streamlined. They look like they're built for speed, and they've got that little notch there. And this is blue whale krill poop. So the krill that goes in, yes, I went to the Commonwealth Club, and the lady showed me pictures of poop. The krill goes in as those little orange-looking shrimp thing and comes out, still carrying a lot of the orange color. And that's if you see that, you know a blue whale's nearby. And that's actually one of the ways we find them when the weather is poor. Gray whales are probably not going to be seen when you're out there, but I wanted to mention them because you might see them. And the reason you might see them, well, I'll hold on that and I'll talk a little about them first. Gray whales are kind of this mottled gray. They're smaller than the blues and the humpbacks. They don't really have a dorsal fin. They just kind of have a bigger bump and a few other bumps. They've got a big notch in their flukes, and they tend to have barnacles all over their heads and all over their tails. The gray whales, I noticed that you're going to have somebody talk about the successes at San Ignacio Lagoon. The gray whales are the stars of that story. They go up and they summer up here in Alaska, and then as summer heads to winter, they come down our coast and they pass by us right here in San Francisco, kind of January-ish. Best place to see them going south is Point Reyes. When they're going south, they're pretty far out to sea, and they're boogieing it all the way down here to Baja. And their favorite places are Scammon's Lagoon, San Ignacio Lagoon, Bahia de Magdalena, places where there's big, shallow estuaries where they can go in and give birth to their calves. The gray whale used to be called the devilfish because when they were hunted, they learned that people mean harpoons and death, so they would attack whale boats, and they were definitely protective of their young. Way back in the, and I can't tell you the year, but I do know that the fishermen at San Ignacio Lagoon, a friend of mine's dad is the first fisherman that stupidly, according to his friends, put his hand out and touched a gray whale and found out that the whale came back. And he went home and he told the other fishermen, hey, I'm petting whales. And they're like, hey, you're smoking dope. They did not believe him, but the story that you'll hear at the presentation in November is that the gray whales now, over time, associate humans with very friendly people who like to pet them, and they actually train their babies. They bring their babies over to see the people. They must go on like people watching tours and sign up and go to things just like us. Gray whales blow kind of a big puffy cloud, but they're described as having a heart-shaped blow. The nostrils are set a little bit to the side, and that one you can kind of see the heart shape of their blow because they're the two little nasal prominences blow in different directions. The reason you might see these gray whales is that for some reason, some would say climate change, some would say other reasons, maybe food abundance, we now seem to have a resident set of gray whales out in the Farallons. So for whatever reason, they've given up their 4,000-mile annual trek. They've settled in the Bay Area. Maybe they've decided not to be snowbirds after all. Maybe it's a societal phenomena. But we do have some gray whales that are out there year-round, and they tend to be right around the islands, kind of to the south. Right where I assume you're going. And they're just kind of gray and barnacle-y looking. Gray whales do breach, but not as often. And if they do breach, you'll see that they have these kind of lobate fins rather than the long arms of humpbacks. And they do spy hop, where they just kind of stick their head up out of the water and turn around slowly like a periscope and check out what's going on, which is rather spooky. That eye is quite spooky. They're very sentient beings. If you make eye contact with a whale, it kind of changes your life because you suddenly realize that it might be smarter than me and it's definitely bigger. They also have uniquely identifiable tails. They often have scars on them. They don't know if the scars are from mating or from deep, deathly battles with giant squid, which is actually something that they really love to eat. They love squid. And we have Humboldt squid out in Cordell. A lot of focus on looking at tails and figuring out what's what. The last kind of whale that we do have out on occasion, I haven't seen them this year, but John Stern, the researcher at UCSF, says they're here, are minke whales. They're very small. They have a sickle-shaped dorsal fin. They move really fast. They look black. And if you see them, that'd be kind of an unusual sighting. And again, that'd be something I'd love to hear from you so we could tell John we saw them. And then you finally get out to the Farallons. I'm almost on schedule. The Farallons are actually the south, the middle, and the north Farallons. And this is an aerial view of what's generally just kind of rocky, craggy out there. There's no real vegetation out there except for something called Farallon weed. It's really hard. There's no beach landings on the Farallons. If you're fortunate enough to go ashore, you hop on some kind of a contraption. This is the old days when they would just kind of get in this little hanging cage. Nowadays, they use a more modern crane, and you go out in the dinghy comes out to your boat and gets you, and then the dinghy is lifted ashore with you in it. It's kind of exciting. The only people who get to go to the islands are the researchers with PRBO Conservation Science and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. If you go around the islands, you should see these two little houses. They're remnant from when the Coast Guard manned the light up here. The PRBO researchers and biologists, Fish and Wildlife Service biologists live here. There's four of them permanent party. This is the temporary quarters for the few researchers that go out in the interim. This is where they used to collect rainwater and hold it in cisterns. Bird guano, rainwater, your drinking water. They now use that for washing, and instead they take drinking water out with Coast Guard vessels four times a year. The Farallon Islands have a rich human history, which I don't have time to talk about. If you want to know an incredibly fascinating story, check out this book. Peter White is one of our volunteers, and he also worked out on the Farallons as a volunteer for a number of years. Great book. Out on the islands, they're known for seabirds. It's the largest seabird colony in the lower 48 states, about 500,000 seabirds out there. I'm going to go really fast through the bird pictures. If you're a birder, I apologize, but there's just too many birds to sit there and talk about all the birds. But the gist of what I want you to walk away with is real estate out there is scarce. It's a little island, and 500,000 birds is a lot of birds. And they've come up with a really cool way to share the real estate. The birds over here on the left all are birds that nest either out in the open on the flats. The black oyster catchers down here intertidal, western gull out here in the flats, Brandt's cormorants down low, common murres in the cliffside, pelagic cormorants on the cliffs. And the ones on the right all dig burrows. And with the exception of the tufted puffin, they hide in their burrows in the night. They leave their burrows before the sun comes up. They go out and hunt all day, and then just after dark, they come back to their burrows. They do that kind of night departure and arrival so that other predators don't know where their burrows are. Except for the tufted puffin, which actually doesn't care if you know where their burrow is, because when we see a picture, you'll see that the bill will do a number on you if you get near their burrow and try to mess with them. Common murres are basically the birds of the Farallons. There's about 300,000 out there. They look like penguins to me. They're little black and white ones. They have no sense of personal space. They essentially, if it's rocky and craggy, they will lay an egg on it. They swim down to about 300 feet, and ecologically, while they look like penguins, they also fill that same ecological niche in the northern hemisphere. So there are those who surmise maybe they're related. Their eggs are not like a chicken egg, but they're actually more pointy. And if you imagine if you put that egg on the kitchen table and gave it a push, it would roll in a circle rather than off the edge. And it's an adaptive mechanism so that the eggs don't fall off the cliffs. It's pretty clever. Problem with the eggs, islands have always been a great place to stop and get eggs and meat. If you're a Spaniard running up and down the coast, or a Russian settler up at Russian River, or a miner 49er during the Gold Rush. During the Gold Rush, the eggers came out and established an egg-gathering company. They gathered, at the beginning, 500,000 eggs a year. And they didn't just gather eggs. They'd go through the colony, smash all the eggs, then come back 2 or 3 days later and get all the newly laid eggs, because those would be the fresh ones. 30 to 40 years of unregulated egging took the breeding population from 300,000 down to 60,000. And finally, a presidential decree stopped the egging, but they had to actually use decoys to lure the MERS back to their traditional nesting areas. This is another long and involved story, but the short version is that those decoys kind of look like MERS, but the MERS are smarter than we think, and so they didn't fall for the ruse. So to make them work, they actually had to take recordings and put little speakers up in the rocks and then hide mirrors in the rocks so that the MERS would hear the noise, come check it out, and see movement in the mirror. That got them back. And they nested. When they're on the water, they look kind of like a cross between a penguin and a duck to me. Another form of bird that was really impacted by eggers are storm petrels, both ashy storm petrels and leeches storm petrels. At the turn of the century, the collection of eggs was a big deal, and ashy storm petrel eggs were worth a lot. And the kids of the lighthouse keepers could make great pocket money gathering them and selling them. That's an ashy. That's a leech's. Actually, the leech's egg looks just like the ashy, so all eggs gathered on the Farallones were called ashy storm petrel eggs, although some might not have been. The gulls that are out on the island also laid eggs that were sold. The gull eggs are littler. The mer eggs are twice the size of a chicken egg. The gull eggs are about the size of a chicken egg. And they're also fragile. I learned this to impress my friends, the difference between a California and a Western gull. California gull, think of Gold Rush, has gold legs. Western gull has pink legs. Cowboy would never be caught dead in a pink shirt. The gulls also nest out there and are responsible for predation on the other eggs. So the other birds have to do things to stop the gulls from getting their eggs. And we talked about the burrows. The other bird back there is a black oyster catcher. He or she lives in the intertidal zone. And they're pretty unique if you see them. Are all black, and they have that really distinct, looks like an orange pencil for a beak and funny little orange feet. And they make very silly little calls. There's three kinds of cormorants out there. Brant's cormorants have the blue under their beak. Pelagic cormorant is either all black or has the little white rump patch. And that's pelagic again. They all look prehistoric to me. The cormorants nest on the flat parts, and you'll notice that unlike the MERS that were like elbow to elbow, cormorants have a personal space issue. They nest about one body length apart, and so they space themselves out to have room to kind of get up and turn around. And then another double-crested cormorant is the third kind out there, and it has the little yellow face without the blue. There's a couple of auklets out there. Auklets are weird little birds. They live in these tunnels. This is a rhinoceros auklet. In flight, it looks like a bird that's improbably short for its wingspan. I call them flying tennis balls because that's what they look like to me. And they've got, the rhinoceros auklets have a bright orange bill on them. And they have that funny little horn if you're close enough to see it. Casson's auklet also looks like a flying tennis ball to me, but he doesn't have the orange beak. Has a little pointy beak. this is the one that when the boat's going through the water, there's the little birds that you're going, oh, don't hit the bird, don't hit the bird, don't hit the bird. And then the bird at the last minute goes, ah, and makes a lot of noise and runs away. That's generally going to be a Casson's auklet. This is a pigeon guillemot. It's another burrowing bird. Looks like the body of a pigeon, the feet of a duck that are orange. Kind of a unique looking little bird. In flight again, orange feet and white wing patches. And then I was told by everybody over at the National Marine Sanctuary office to jump up and down and say, you will not see a tufted puffin. You will not see a tufted puffin. They're supposed to all be gone by now. They're supposed to have all left in September. I think I saw one last week. I was told I was wrong. If you see a tufted puffin, let me know. There might be one out there that's deviant. Big, thick bodies, gigundo bills. Generally, these birds are really wild and really bizarre to me. They come in from the middle of the Pacific. They nest. By July or August, the babies are out swimming around. by September, October, they and the babies have headed out to the Pacific, where they're going to stay out the North Pacific storm season in open water. And they're going to stay there until they come back to land to nest again. So they're really awesomely cool little birds, just because they're unique. They also swim underwater and look a lot like penguins. That beak, as you can see, if it got hold of you while you were trying to plunder its eggs, would do a number on you. So they actually do enter and leave their burrows by day. Marbled murrelets, just kind of unique in that they breed in fir forests, but they hang out in the ocean. They're also a little black and white, kind of motley-looking guys. And then brown pelicans don't actually nest out on the islands, but they do nest along the coast here in the sanctuary. Northern fulmars are another pelagic bird. They spend most of their life out at sea, but they have something interesting going on their bills. And they have lots of different colors. And they like to eat scraps of dead things, like things that sharks eat. Shearwaters, kind of neat birds. What's neat about these birds is they commute from California to New Zealand and back. This is the largest migration known of birds, 40,000 miles. It's like, why? Why is they come up here to eat because of the incredible diversity, and they go down to New Zealand to breed. Different kind of shearwater. Jaegers, interesting birds that generally make a living stealing other birds' food. Jaegers, depending on where you're from. Black-footed albatross, excuse me. These are kind of neat in that these albatross nest at Midway Island. That's Hawaii. That's Midway Island. That's about 3,000-4,000 miles. And they... This track doesn't show it. This is a satellite track. These birds lay the eggs. The birds, the little hatchlings hatch. The parent comes back, feeds here at the Farallons and Coronel Bank, takes the food back to Midway Island, regurgitates it to feed the chick. They commute that distance to feed their chicks. You probably won't see these, so I'm going to go really quickly to get through to the fun part, which is the sharks. Doll's porpoises to me look like panda bears underwater. They're about the size of a harbor porpoise. And if you look over and you see these, like, rooster tails zipping through the water at warp speed, it's a doll's porpoise. They just move and jump really fast. We haven't seen orca this year or killer whales, but they are out there. They sometimes come close to the boat. You'll always see the big dorsal fin. You can kind of see the face there. That's actually last year. Don't see one of those out there. There's Rizzo's dolphins, or Grampus, and I just throw this in. If you see something gray with a big dorsal fin that looks like somebody has scratched it all up, it's a Rizzo's dolphin. They always have these scratches on them. They don't actually know why. There's lots of theories, but no one can prove anything. And then the last of the really strange, the northern right whale dolphin. This is like the animal that has too many names. It has no dorsal fin whatsoever. These you might see out there. This is a mola mola, or an ocean sunfish. It's the strangest thing I've ever seen. Never seen them till I moved here. In the water, they just kind of look like, to me, that looks like a jet plane or something. They've definitely been hunted. They're great eating. Leatherback sea turtles. We actually have all four of the world's sea turtles, but if you see one out there, it's most likely a leatherback. Leatherbacks also commute from here over to the Philippines. This is about a two-year journey that they do. Come over here and eat, go over there, lay eggs, raise young, come back here and eat. And elephant seals, also not the season for elephant seals, but the reason that the sharks come. These are male elephant seals fighting for dominance. Elephant seals are kind of weird. The moms show up in December. Within a few days of showing up, they give birth to a pup. While the moms are nursing the pups, the males are fighting over who gets to mate. The big males in there fighting for dominance can squish pups or injure the pups, but pretty much this is really fast cycle where mom gives birth, nurses for a month, mates, and there's actually a period of delayed implantation. The elephant seals in that population all have a delayed implantation. The egg is fertilized, the fetus starts to grow and stops, and it doesn't implant into the uterus until the mom leaves the area where she's been nursing. So it allows them to mate on a 12-month cycle, but gestate on a 10-month cycle. It's very weird. It's kind of an interesting adaptation. The little baby elephant seals are the reason that we have such a great amalgamation of sharks, because the elephant seals and the sea lions and everybody who has babies, babies are cute and babies have a lot of fat on them and babies are easy prey. This is actually just where the elephant seals travel in a given year. So this is, somebody was talking earlier, must have been you, about the hard part of nature. This cute little guy is the reason that we move into having sharks. Little sidestep, this is a Guadalupe fur seal, and if you see a seal doing this thing called a jug handle, they all do it. It's a really strange thing. That's either a Guadalupe or a northern fur seal. They're really cute. There are two sharks out there. This is a basking shark, and you just kind of see this shark kind of cruising around, and they're terrifying looking, but they actually eat krill. Unlike, oh my goodness, where did these come from? These are the Steller sea lions. And the Steller sea lions are also year-round residents out there. Steller sea lions are the biggest of the sea lions. They're brown in color. And they're actually not as prevalent. Now we move on to the sharks, which is the part I definitely wanted to make sure we covered. Anybody here not read The Devil's Teeth? Okay. Anybody that knows anything about the Farallons always says, oh, and I read The Devil's Teeth. This is about the shark research that has gone on until a few years ago out at the Farallons, and it's kind of got the inside backstory. Shark attacks, we worry about them. That doesn't actually happen. Shark bites along the California coast, people definitely worry about white sharks. There's a thing called the Red Triangle from Tomales Point to the Farallon Islands, to Año Nuevo. And actually, they've proven now that the white sharks do come in the Golden Gate, so they are in the bay. They go around Alcatraz and check things out. But the truth of the matter is that white shark attacks are dying from a shark of any type is less likely than dying from being hit on the head by a falling coconut, is one of the good statistics I've heard. Don't sit under the coconut tree. When white sharks attack, they generally are mistaking the surfer who's on the board for the seal on the right. You can kind of see how it could be confusing. And they do believe that most white shark attacks on people are mistaken identity. They really are going after the elephant seals, who are tasty treats with lots of fat and nutrition. The elephant seals live in the intertidal zone or up there right against the edge of the water, and they have to navigate out through these waves, and the sharks kind of hang out and wait for them. When they do attack, and I use the word attack because it's the word I've always used. The scientists want us to say predation event. So when there is a predation event or an attack, there's blood in the water. These sharks hit hard, and then they let the animal bleed out, and then they come back and they eat in a most genteel way. It's really rather strange. Like when you see them on TV, they bite and thrash and do all this aggressive stuff. White sharks don't hunt that way. They hit their prey once really hard, let it bleed out and die, and then come back and take nibbles. You can see, aside from the blood in the water and little bits of flesh, if you're out there and you see a bunch of seabirds swirling around, go over and look. It's probably a shark predation event. They used to study sharks by doing things like taking pictures of fins, and this is a fin in 2008 and the same fin in 2009. Fins are unique to each shark, and they would track sharks by taking pictures of their fins. You can imagine that's fairly opportunistic science. Then a researcher down in Guadalupe, when the water was clear, started using the patterns on the side of the shark to try to study them. But again, you have to be in the water with the sharks taking pictures of them to do that kind of research. So they moved on to telemetry and putting on these pop-up archival tags. And what they do is they put it on kind of a harpoon thing. They lure the sharks over, and this boat might be out there when you go. This is the Derrick and Bayless, and the researchers are with, it's Barbara Block and the Stanford MCSI folks, or the, Scripps folks, and the Bayless is their research platform. When a shark comes near, they lure them near the boat, they poke them with that tag, and they stick the tag into the shark, and it rides around on the shark for a while. Eventually, it pops loose and comes to the surface and transmits all of its data to a satellite and let you know what happened. Another kind of research that has been done and is currently under an environmental assessment is a researcher actually bolts a spot tag, just like a spot device, to a shark fin. And the bolting of the tag onto the shark means that the shark has to be pulled from the water, has to have holes drilled in its fin, and the tag has to be bolted to it. On the positive side, I guess, of that is that they do get data for several years. They can do things like know that most of the sharks are out at the Farallones. They go up to Tomales Point, they go to Point Reyes, and they go to Año Nuevo. They go to these two places because that's where all the elephant seals are. This is a really hard to decipher diagram, but it's where the pop-up archival types tags show up. And this is the interpretation of what those tags told the scientists, that the sharks hang out here, they go out to the cafe, they go to Hawaii, and they come back. And it's actually kind of an interesting thing. The males go out to the cafe, go to Hawaii, and come back. They do that every year. So the males do that little loop once a year. The females do it every other year. So the sharks you see out at the Farallones, the males come back every year. When they go with these tags, they also, besides knowing where they are, they know how deep they are. When they go from here and they go out to the cafe, en route, they're just kind of cruising near the surface. When they get to the cafe, they hang out there from April, May through July, August, and they do these bounce dives, for lack of a better term, multiple 40, 50, 60 dives down to incredible depths, back to the surface, down, up, down, up. The only other animal that kind of does that is a giant squid. Giant squid are also found in the area. Theory is they're hunting giant squid. Can't prove it, but that's kind of the thinking, is they go out to the cafe and munch down on giant squid in the summer season. They go over to Hawaii. Food isn't much in abundance there, so they aren't sure why they go to Hawaii. I think they're smart. I would go to Hawaii if I had the means to go. And then they come back here, and they feed on those tasty treats of baby elephant seals and sea lions. This is kind of a neat type of research because it's based out of San Francisco. These are our sharks, and it's kind of cool to see where they go. The last thing about the sharks, and then I'll stop, is we have our Farallon Island sharks. They go to the cafe. Some go to Hawaii. They come back. There's some Guadalupe Island sharks down here that another researcher is studying. Those sharks go to the cafe, go to Hawaii, go back. They've only seen one shark that ever moved from San Francisco to Mexico, and no sharks have moved from Mexico to San Francisco. Sharks are smart. I would go to Mexico too. And I'm going to stop right there. Thank you for your attention.
What is a whale doing when it blows?
That's actually a good question. It's breathing in a deep fashion. So when it comes up to the surface, it's not only exhaling and trying to get air in, it's also clearing its nose, just like we would clear a snorkel. And the little nostrils collect water, and that's why you get the vapor steam. They've got big lungs, and they have a lot of tissue to make oxygenated, and so they have to do a really aggressive purge and intake of air to be able to get enough air exchange. That's a good question.
I've heard a little bit about how sonar imaging affects whales because they are, from what I've heard, very audio-oriented creatures. Could you comment on, you know, any, I guess, information in the field as far as how that's affecting whales, generally speaking, just sonar?
In general.
Yeah.
I can tell you I don't know a lot about sonar, and they haven't done a lot of sonar studies here. They have up in Washington and Puget Sound, and they definitely are seeing, they believe, correlations between the use of that really loud sonar and then marine mammal stranding events. The other sound issue that's really come up now, and it's actually going to be more and more in the news, is the ship noise. And that type of rumbling is in the same audio spectrum as the communication frequencies, especially of blue whales. They're in the exact same frequency spectrum. And so the kind of related to your question, the fact that we have the world's largest aggregation of the world's most endangered whale out here, and we know that vessel traffic noise interferes with their ability to communicate, is that something that should be addressed? And there's a lot of repercussions to your solution, so that discussion is going to be coming up in the news in the next few years.
Yes, you mentioned the three groupings of whales.
Mm-hmm. Of the humpbacks.
And I was wondering, if it's a if it changes every other if it changes every year slightly, does it go in a say a multi-year cycle?
No, actually, that's a good question. The groups of whales, the three groups, they remain absolutely separate. They don't mix. So, and again, I'm making these statements based on past research, which was based on observation. Right now, they're starting to put satellite tags on animals and go, oh, what we've always said might not hold true. So the current answer to your question is no, they stay separate, and no, there's no cycling. But in 3 to 4 years, when they get some new data, that answer could change.
Has there ever been a witnessed predation event from white sharks inside the Golden Gate?
No. The witnessed predation events have all been out around the Farallon Islands from the scientist, and the fact that they come in the Golden Gate and we can prove it is new. The fellow that put that bolted tag on, Michael Domeyer, just released this past year that it's generally in August, September, that the sharks are coming in the gate. He actually sat on the information, not wanting to freak everybody out. But there's been no known predation or feeding or even evidence of a predation inside the gate, for what that's worth.
Anybody else?
You didn't touch on history, but the nuclear waste that was supposed to be dumped around there, could you just elaborate a little bit about that?
It's one of the things that I find most fascinating. The USS Independence was part of Bikini Atoll. It was hauled back from Bikini Atoll and deemed too irradiated to bring into the bay. And so it was sunk out somewhere south and west of the Farallons. And after that event and kind of during it for about a 20-30 year period, the Navy and some other places did dump radioactive and munitions out here, supposedly, in these particular spots and over the edge of the escarpment. Now, I say supposedly that this is before GPS. So it's going to depend on how good of a navigator you are. And if you go out there and you don't have a calm day, you'll go, how motivated am I to really go 5 miles past the Farallons to throw this stuff off? So there's been concern that things didn't actually end up where they were supposed to. They have mapped the bottom, and they've mapped it to this is like a one-inch resolution map. And when they've analyzed the images, they have found barrels. This is a remnant barrel. And unfortunately, the barrels, when they were offloaded from the boats, they were shot at to make them sink. And they're also corroding. So they can find them when they monitor for any signs of radioactive leakage. You know, with the classic Geiger counters or any measurements, they don't find anything. This is one of those problems where I kind of compare it to coffee. Everybody says it should be bad for you, but nobody can prove it. So I'll say keep drinking it. This should be a big problem. But when they go out and try to find evidence of the radioactive leakage, they don't. And so one of the scientists who has been trying to find evidence that bad things are happening believes that just the sheer volume and strength of the California current sweeping down the coast is diluting that slow release of radioactive waste. It's a nice way to help you sleep at night, but it's a problem that doesn't have an easy answer, but it is one that the sanctuary staff is really cognizant of. And it's a really, for me, it's a very important issue.
Anyone else? Okay, great. Well, Terry, thank you so much for all this information. And I know for those of us that are heading out to the Farallons, it will certainly add to our trip. You are all welcome to stay afterwards, ask me any questions about the logistics of the trip, or, of course, to talk to Terry if you have any further questions. So thank you very much to Terry Watson, Executive Director. Executive Director of the Farallons Marine Sanctuary Association. You can look up their organization online if you want to get some more information and learn more about the Farallons and supporting their organization. And this meeting tonight of the Commonwealth Club is officially adjourned.